So for this week's sutta class, we're having a look at one of the saddest suttas in the whole Majjhima Nikaya. In fact, a sutta which is so monumentally sad that I dare you to read it without weeping. Well, let's see who gets... Well, it's not that the sutta itself is sad. It's that it gives such beautiful and sane and sensible advice, which is so systematically ignored by just about everybody in Buddhism, that it makes you weep to think about it. It makes me weep anyway. So here we go. The Devadaha Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 101, and as we can see, has... Sorry? Majjhima Nikaya 101 has one corresponding sutta in the Majjhima Agama 19, of course being the Sarvastivadin collection. So, the online version of the Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation is missing the first several pages, and he only has a few pages there. So for the English translation on the screen, we'll have Venerable Tanisaro's translation, but as usual I'll be reading from Bhikkhu Bodhi's. As have I heard, on one occasion the Blessed One was living in the Sakyan country where there was a town of the Sakyans named Devadaha. There the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus. Bhikkhus, Venerable Sir, they replied, the Blessed One said this. But he said, bhikkhus, there are some recluses and Brahmins who hold such a doctrine and view as this. Whatever this person feels, whether pleasure or pain, or neither pain nor pleasure, all that is caused by what was done in the past. So by annihilating with asceticism past actions, and by doing no fresh actions, there will be no consequence in the future. With no consequence in the future, there is the destruction of action, karma. With the destruction of karma, there is the destruction of suffering. With the destruction of suffering, there is the destruction of feeling. With the destruction of feeling, all suffering will be exhausted. So speak the Nigantas, because... So here's the opening statement. Nigantas, of course, being the usual term known in the suttas for the Jaina community, who we of course met many times, and the word Nigamta is Ni, and Gamta Ni meaning without, Gamta meaning a knot or a tie, so meaning without ties or bondless, something like that. So, as so often with these names, the word Nigamta is a descriptive epithet which they would have used to describe themselves, and which would have applied pretty much, in terms of its meaning, would apply just as well to Buddhism as it would to Jainism, but for whatever reason becomes associated with the Jaina community. And of course the word Jain itself comes from the word Jina, meaning victor. And the abstract noun from that is Jaina. Okay. So, and that kind of abstract is used to mean the followers of a religion. This is a bit kind of by the way, but so in Buddhism, the Jina is the victor, was the head of the Jains, and the Jaina is one of their followers. So in the same way, you have the Buddha. And the Indic word for the Sanskrit word for a follower of the Buddha is Baudha, in the same sort of way. So that's how you say Buddhist in Sanskrit, Baudha. Okay, so let's have a bit of a more close look at the initial statement of the Buddha, and let's tease out these things more specifically. Okay, so Santi Bhikkhave Eke Samana Brahmana. There are amongst certain Eke Samana Brahmana, Eka from the word one, Eka, But ekai used in this sense is a plural sense. So there are, as you translate, there are certain samanas and brahmanas, certain ascetics. Interesting usage here that it's talking about samanas and brahmanas as this kind of conventional compound, but of course they're talking about the nigantas, who are not brahmanas at all, who are of such a vada and such a ditti. So notice how these words are used here. So the word vada is the same as the second element in Theravada or Sarvastivada, these kinds of words, meaning a doctrine. Okay, so the Theravada, the doctrine of the elders, and later becomes means the school of the elders. So they are evanvadino and evandiktino, such a doctrine and such a view. So this is the normal way that these words are used in Pali. Okay, so this is the statement, and here's their view. Whatever, Gankinchi, whatever, I am Purisapugalo, this person, Purisapugala being a compound meaning like an individual, find it in the phrase of the Sangha, yeah, Atta Purisapugala, kind of individuals, experiences, Patisangvedeti, whatever this experience, this individual experiences with a sukha, this pleasure, dukkha, pain, adukkama sukha, neither pain nor pleasure. All of that, sabantam pobbe kata hetu. So this is a critical term here. Pubbe kata hetu. Pubbe is in the past. Pubbe kata means was done. Hetu is caused. Okay, so hetu is the cause. So everything that you experience, whether pleasure or pain or neutral, that all that is caused by what was done in the past. And the word what was done, kata, is grammatically is just the past participle from the word kamma. So later on we have the word kamma. There's no difference in meaning, it's just a different grammatical form of the word. That's why they use kata here, whereas kamma here, but it's the same word, so don't be misled by that. So what it means is everything that you experience in this lifetime was caused by karma, which you've done in your past lifetime. And of course this being the doctrine which is taught very widely in Buddhism, we've discussed it many times in the monastery, we were discussing it just the other day with the Mitra people who are here, and it comes up again and again, because this doctrine, sabbang tang pubbe kata hetu, is of course almost always taught as if it was a Buddhist teaching.
When you say in the past, does it specifically say past
lives? It doesn't specifically say past lives here, but that's pretty much what it means. You can see that kind of emerges in a number of contexts, but that's pretty much what they mean, yeah. Remembering that it's a Jaina view, so their view of rebirth and so on is fairly similar to the Buddhist idea that you've sort of had a countless series of past lives where you've been making karma and so on. Thus, purananam kamanam, thus the old kamas, the old acts, tapasa bhyanti bhava, by means of tapas, destroyed or annihilated. So tapas, of course, being the ascetic fervour, the heat, the fire of ascetic acts, the performance of austerities, navanam kamanam akarana, so not doing newcomers, in other words, so by avoiding acting in this life. So this is this kind of very kind of negative conception of sila, which you find has a tendency in Buddhism sometimes, but it was even stronger in the Jaina community, which was that the right way to behave was to avoid making any kind of kamma. And so that's why they would, and remember that the Jains interpreted kamma as including unintentional action. So this is why they would do stuff like, you know, sweep the path in front of them when they're walking along and so on, to avoid stepping on any insects and these kinds of things. So they're trying to not make any kamma in the present lifetime. Okay? So by doing no fresh actions, there's no consequence in the future. ayating anavasava. So this is the root here is sava, to flow. So there'll be nothing that flows on to the future. When there's nothing that flows on to the future, then there is an ending of karma. When there is an ending of karma, there's an ending of dukkha. When there's an ending of dukkha, there's an ending of vedana, feeling. And the ending of vedana, all dukkha, nidirnam, is worn away. This is the doctrine of the Jains. Let's before going on, let's have a look at the comparative study and see what similarities there might be or not with the Sarvastivadin version. Devadaha's Sutta and its Madhyama Agama parallel begin by describing the view of the Nigantas that the effective quality of one's present experience is determined by former deeds, whose effect can, however, be annihilated by ascetic practices. According to the Pali presentation, the view held by the Nigantas was that the destruction of former deeds, former karma, leads to the destruction of dukkha, and the destruction of dukkha leads to the destruction of feeling, vedana, whereby all dukkha will be overcome. The Madhyama Agama account of the same view does not mention the destruction of feeling, or vedana, so that its account simply indicates that the destruction of former karma leads to the destruction of dukkha, whereby all dukkha will be transcended. Okay, so can you see that difference between the two? Whereas in the Pali version, you say, by the end, you'll wear away through asceticism your old karma. Now you won't make any new karma. By doing that, then there will be no consequence in the future. When there's no consequence in the future, there'll be an ending of karma. When there's an ending of karma, there's an ending of dukkha. When there's an ending of dukkha, there'll be an ending of feeling. So that last phrase is not found in the Sarvastivadin version. And it seems to be quite reasonable. It's a bit peculiar, because of course dukkha is either a part of vedana, or certainly is very closely related to it. And so why it goes from dukkha then to vedana, and then from vedana back to the ending of dukkha again, is a little bit, has always been a bit obscure to me. So I sort of chalked it up to the fact that the Jaina doctrine was not particularly coherent, but it looks like in fact it's the Pali text which is a bit gone a little bit astray there. Presentation found in the Pali version of the Devadaha Sutta recurs in the Chula Dukkha Kandha Sutta and in a discourse found in the Anguttara Nikaya. These two Pali discourses have counterparts in the Madhyama Agama discourse, the Samyutta Agama discourse, and the Kottara Agama discourse, and in two individual translations. Though these Chinese parallels stem from quite a range of different textual traditions, none of them mentions feelings in this context. Okay, so it's not just this particular parallel, but in every other place that appears in the Chinese, there's no mention of dukkha there. No mention of vedana in that context. In fact, to propose that with the destruction of former karma, all dukkha will be destroyed is straightforward enough, and there would seem to be no need to additionally bring in feelings. Moreover, one might wonder if the ascetics engaged in self-mortification and therewith in practices that generated painful feelings would envisage the destruction of feeling as a goal of their aspiration. This is perhaps more appropriate than the thought world of the Buddhist monks who recorded the view. I'm highly convinced by that, but in any case, it seems clear enough that the section on vedana was not, shouldn't be there. Okay, so the next part, the Buddha goes on to recount his examination of the Nigantas. So I go to the Nigantas who speak thus, and I say, "Friend Nigantas, is it true that you hold such a doctrine and a view as this? Whatever a person feels or suffers would be exhausted if, when they're asked that, the Nigantas admit this and say, 'Yes, I say to them.'" Okay, so notice this first stage in the way that the Buddha approaches the dialogue. Yeah, so even though he's the Buddha, he knows a thing or two, right? He doesn't go there and say, "I know what you guys are teaching, and it's like this and this," but he asked to confirm. Yeah? So the first thing is say, "Well, is this really true? Is this actually what you're teaching?" And as we know from the Vinaya and so on, that this is how the Buddha would always operate. And so then he would say, But friends, do you know that you existed in the past and that it is not the case that you did not exist? So kind of double negative there, but basically the idea, did you exist in the past? And they said, no, we don't know that. But friends, do you know that you did evil actions in the past and did not abstain from them? No, friend. But friends, do you know that you did such and such kind of evil actions in the past? No, friend. But friends, do you know that so much suffering has already been exhausted, or that so much suffering has still to be exhausted, or that when so much suffering has been exhausted, all suffering will have been exhausted? Exhausted here means finished or ended. Yeah, the word is kaya. No, friends. But friends, do you know that with the abandoning of unwholesome dhammas, unskillful mental qualities, and the cultivation of skillful mental qualities is like here and now? And so the Buddha said, and they said, no, friends. So it seems you don't know any of these things, and therefore it's not proper for you to make this assertion. Okay, so the kind of typical example of practicing according to blind faith. The two versions, back to the comparative study, Venerable Analia continues with his analysis. The two versions describe in similar terms how the Buddha examined the position of the Nigantas. A minor difference in their descriptions is that according to the Pali account, he questioned the Nigantas if they knew what kind of evil deed they did in the past. This question differs from the other three questions found in both versions alike. These three questions that are alike are if the Nigantas knew that they'd existed in the past, that they'd done evil deeds in their past existence, and that their present practice was a way to eradicate dukkha. Each of these three questions undermines the premises of the asceticism of the Nigantas. The question found only in the Pali version, however, does not really pose a challenge to their asceticism, since for the practice to yield results, it would not be relevant to know exactly what kind of evil deed they'd done in the past, as long as they knew that they had done evil deeds at all, and that their present practice would eradicate their retribution. Thus, from the perspective of the dynamic of the argumentation, the question found only in the Pali version fixed the context less well than three questions found in both versions. So that seems to be straightforward enough. So there's an extra question there, you know, slipped into the Pali somehow. And so the Buddha recapitulates that the statement and then goes on to give the very famous simile of the an arrow. Friend Nigantas, suppose a man were wounded by an arrow thickly smeared with poison. Because of this he felt painful, racking and piercing feelings. Then his friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives brought a surgeon. The surgeon would cut around the opening of the wound with a knife, probe the arrow with a probe, pull out the arrow and apply a medicinal powder to the opening of the wound. And at each step the man would feel painful, racking and piercing feelings. Then on a later occasion, when the wound was healed and covered with skin, the man would be well and happy, independent, master of himself, able to go where he likes. He might think, formerly I was pierced by an arrow, thickly smeared with poison, and because of this I felt painful, racking, piercing feelings. And my friends and companions, kinsmen and relatives brought a surgeon. The surgeon cut around the opening of the wound with a knife and pulled it out and cleaned it. At each stage in that, but I felt painful feelings, but now the wound is healed and covered with skin. I am well and happy, independent, my own master, able to go where I like. So too, friends, if you knew that you existed in the past and that it's not the case you did not exist, and if you knew all those other things, then it would be fitting for you to say whatever this person, say the doctrine that had been attributed to you. So in other words, that in this case, the person can see the actual connections between the pain and the wound and so on, and the healing. Whereas in the case of the Nigantas argument, they're not able to see anything. So basic position in Buddhism, which I've emphasized many times, which is that Buddhist teachings are always empirical. That means that they're derived from evidence, or they're inferred from evidence, from what can actually be known and experienced. They're not based on metaphysical claims, which are claims about things which are intrinsically unknowable. Okay, so there's a difference between things which are merely unknown because we haven't experienced them yet, and things which are actually unknowable. In this case, the Nigantas had no not only didn't have any knowledge of those acts of the past, but they had no knowledge of how they might come to have knowledge of those things. Okay? And that's implied when they say that they don't know anything about the development of wholesome dhammas in the present moment. Okay? So, of course, the ability to recollect past lives and to know all these things is based on development of meditation, purification of the mind, and so on and so forth. So they've implicitly admitted that they don't even know how to go about finding out whether these things are in fact true or whether there's anything to this. So from the beginning to the end, they haven't got anything to rely on except for blind faith. So this is the difference with the Buddhist point of view. The Buddhist point of view, you might not actually know, but at least you have a way that you understand that you can seek for knowledge and redress the ignorance which you currently have. Okay? So then, to address this epistemological problem, the Nigantas then respond with another point back to the Buddha. When this was said, the Nigantas said to me, "Friend, Nigantha Nataputta, their teacher," okay, so Nigantha, I've explained, means without bonds, and Nataputta, Nata is a dancer, and Putta is the son, okay, so the dancer's son. And according to the traditional biography of Nigantha Nataputta, who's known more commonly as Mahavira, the great hero, he was born in Vaisali to a very wealthy Kshatriya family in Vaisali, and his mother of course was a dancer, actually his life story is told in ways that's fairly similar to the Buddha's own life story, although it's difficult to know which version has influenced which, because the Nigantha Nataputta himself was older than the Buddha. But the Jaina texts are much younger than the Buddha's texts. Okay, so all of the Jaina texts, according to the Jains' own account, their old texts were all lost. And they were kind of only partially or incompletely reconstructed in around the 4th or 5th century. So it's the historical situation with regard to the authenticity of the Jaina texts is even much more difficult than it is regarding the Buddhist texts. Okay, so, friend, the Nigantha Nataputta is all-knowing, all-seeing, and claims total knowledge and vision. Thus, whether I'm walking or standing, sleeping or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and continually established in me, uninterruptedly established. He has told us, Nigantas, there are evil actions that you have done in the past. Exhaust them with these painful austerities. When in the present you are restrained in body, restrained in speech, and restrained in mind, that is the non-doing of evil action for the future. Thus, with the destruction of old actions, old karma, through asceticism, and by doing no fresh karma, there will be no consequence in the future. With no consequence in the future, there's the ending of karma, with the ending of karma, the ending of dukkha, with the ending of dukkha, the ending of feeling. With the ending of feeling, all suffering and stress will be exhausted. All dukkha will be exhausted. We approve of that teaching, accept it, and are gratified by it. Okay? So the Nigantas are responding to this epistemological critique which the Buddha made. He said, you're doing this practice and you haven't got any way of knowing what the practice is about. And they claim that, well, their source of knowledge is their teacher, who is omniscient, all-knowing and all-seeing. And so this is their response. Okay, and these are the words used for to describe the omniscient Nigantha Nataputta: sabbanyu, sabba all, anyu knowing, sabba dasavi all-seeing. Parisesang is that complete or limit without remainder. Knowledge and vision, he knows the remainderless knowledge and vision. Whether walking, standing, lying down, or sleeping, then he has a continual, uninterrupted knowledge and mindfulness is established. Okay, so he's the one who teaches that doctrine. So that's a perfectly logical response. Okay, if it indeed is the case that there is a teacher who knows everything, then of course it's perfectly reasonable to follow what they say. Yeah, because the question raises two questions. First of all, is he really omniscient? Does he really know everything? And the second question is, how do you know? Yeah, he might be or might not be omniscient, but how are we supposed to tell whether they're omniscient or not? And one of the great problems which you always find in religious circles is that because of the assumption of authority by the spiritual teacher, the students are all too ready to impute this kind of omniscience to their teacher, which often turns out to be unwarranted. So sometimes it gives a simile where somebody who makes this kind of claim about being omniscient then walks into town and gets bitten by a dog, and people say, how do you get bitten by a dog if you know everything? And then he says, I had to get bitten by a dog, that's why I got bitten by a dog, and so on and so forth. And the kind of things that sound like a joke, but actually exactly the same things have happened. We had a case in Australia a number of years ago. A monk got arrested for various kinds of fairly gross behaviours, and in his court case he claimed to be able to tell the future. And so why he hadn't been able to foresee the fact that he was going to be arrested is that monk was perhaps unique in possibly accomplishing all four Parajika offences.
Do the Jains still believe this?
Well, that's a good question. Did they ever believe it is another question. It's certainly in line with the general tendency of Jaina belief. Yeah, I personally think that the Buddhist texts, generally speaking, represent the Jaina texts fairly well. Yeah, the Jaina beliefs fairly well. Although it's not easy because, as I said, their existing texts are much later, and it's, you know, this kind of give and take where you've got debate, then people would always be adjusting their doctrines to accommodate the critiques of their opponents. Yeah, so. But certainly the general tenor of it is okay. We do have some Jaina suttas downstairs if anyone wants to read it. So it's very interesting to read some of their texts.
If Buddhist texts might
not
be maligning anything, but it's not. Obviously, doesn't think it's correct.
Right.
And, but Jaina's inside,
right.
And Buddhism.
Right. Well, the thing about Jainism is, of course, that any religion, but even more so, the people who are actually practicing it is only a tiny minority of the actual community. So within the Jaina monastic community, because it's so tough, has always been far smaller than the Buddhist one, relative to the size of their community as such. Yeah? For fairly obvious reasons. Right? And so in a sense, what that tended to mean in terms of the development of the religion was that the whole kind of monastic thing was much less prominent. They didn't have the big universities and stuff like that you had in
Islander.
Got under the radar a bit. And in fact, often in the Jaina communities, they didn't have any sangha. So that they had actually like an in-between class who were like acharyas, but lay acharyas. So, you know, a bit like our lay teachers of today, or like the Zen priests and so on. And they would do the rituals, the chanting, and the passing down of the basic teachings and so on for the Jaina community. And that was very common, I believe still is common in the Jaina communities, precisely because there's so few monks and nuns around to do the actual teaching relative to the size of the community. So again, then that meant that, of course, these lay teachers were living in the village like anybody else and would be passed over when everything was destroyed by the Muslim invaders. So, yeah, there's possibly one reason why they survived. So yeah, I'm not sure whether it has... There's various arguments about whether it actually does have anything to do with the doctrines or not. And that's also possible. One of the things about Jainism is that the basic philosophy of Jainism is, you see, in Hinduism you always have this tendency to identify the Atman, the individual Atman, with the cosmic. Yeah? So it's always this sort of melding of the small with the big. Yeah? This is the kind of the movement of Hinduism. Of the Brahmanical texts. But what that meant, but that's like an individual religious doctrine, but it has a social implication as well, because the whole long-term historical development of Hinduism is precisely the melding of countless thousands of individual local sects and Deva worship and Naga worship and Yaka worship, everything, in thousands and thousands of villages all over India, who all became one with the great religion of Hinduism. Yeah? So can you see that kind of parallel? Just like the individual soul becomes one with the cosmic soul, the same way the individual religion practiced here in my village becomes one with the cosmic religion, which is practiced everywhere in the civilized world, that they knew of. And so that had that movement in Hinduism. In Buddhism, of course, you have the not-self doctrine and the doctrine of conditionality, which in kind of a similar way opens itself up to that idea of the relationship and the connection between all kinds of things. Yeah? And so the Buddhist teachings, they did keep a distinctness in the sense of knowing that they were Buddhists, but they also were quite happy to adopt a lot of ideas and so on from all around them. Yeah? So one of the things that happened to Buddhism in India, of course, was that it melted away into Hinduism. Yeah? It became so interconnected that it couldn't distinguish itself. It didn't have a self anymore. The Atman, yeah? The individual soul of Buddhism, became sort of disappeared into the Hindu ideas. So in a sense, it didn't disappear from India, but it became absorbed within Hinduism. Yeah, so there's lots of Buddhist ideas you find in Hinduism. Whereas with Jainism, they always have the idea of the soul as an individual monad. Yeah? It's irreducibly individual. Right? And it's ultimately not connected with anything else in the world. Right? Contingently it's connected. But in the ultimate sense, that individual soul that each person has will survive. Like the purified soul lives as an individual all-knowing entity forever. That's the Jain idea of liberation. So the Jaina communities also sort of kept themselves more isolated and more distinct. There was less of a tendency to adopt all of the Hindu deities and tantric practices and all of these kinds of things that we see, especially in the late phase of Buddhism in India. They always kept themselves more individual. So that's possibly another reason for the reason that they survived. And in that sense, they didn't. It's not that Buddhism didn't survive, but the Buddhists didn't survive individually. It survived in terms of being absorbed or melding. Yeah. Okay, so then the Jains, having brought up this epistemological response to the Buddha's critique, the Jains then come up with another. So the Buddha then responds to their answer. So notice how, you know, this discussion is going on. it's actually a real engagement. Yeah? Again, this is a great example of interfaith dialogue. That they're not sitting around saying, oh yes, we all believe in the same thing anyway, right? Nor do they just dismiss each other out of hand and not listen to what everybody else is saying. They're listening to what each other's saying and they're making meaningful responses to it. Yeah? There's a meaningful dialogue going on. When this was said, I said to the Nigantas, friend Nigantas, there are five things that can turn out in two ways in the here and now. Which five? Okay? Faith, approval. Oh, sorry, actually, one thing I should come back to before we go on to that. We approve of that teaching, prefer it, and are gratified in it, by it, as Chanisara has, or Bhikkhu Bodhi has. We approve of and accept this, and so we are satisfied. Let's show you what the Pali is there. Tancha panamhakan ruchati jeva kamati cha. Okay? Tena chamha atamana. So the last word here, atamana, is the same word that's used at the end of all the discourses that they rejoiced in the Vaishnavas' teaching. But the two words here are interesting, ruchati jeva kamati cha. So ruchi, translated as approval by Bhikkhu Bodhi, which is probably pretty good. Tanisara has also has approve. Yeah. So this is the same word when the Buddha rejected Mahapajapati's request for ordination. He said ma ruchi. Okay, don't approve of that. Okay. Has that kind of meaning. It's a little bit difficult. It kind of means to like something or to agree with something, but it is used specifically in this context of having the view for something. We accept that view of something. And similarly, the word kamati is the verb related to the noun kanti, which we usually translate as patient endurance. But it also has the meaning of accept. So here again has the meaning of accepting a view. So these are two synonyms here. We approve of or acquiesce and accept that view. Okay. And notice that ruchi, it's found here, is also found in the list of five things that the Buddha is going to meet. Five ways of that a view can be accepted. It'll have two outcomes, and also kamti. Kamati is also here as well. Okay, so the five, when this was said, return to the Buddha now, taking up the epistemological argument of the Nigantas. The Buddha said, friend Nigantas, there are five things that can turn out in two ways in the here and now. Which five? Conviction, faith, liking, ruchi, approval or to like something. Notice how Tanisaro translates ruchi as approve up here and like down here. This is one of the reasons why Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations are always much better to read, because it's much more precise. Oral tradition, reasoned cogitation, reasoning by analogy, perhaps not really, but, and reflective acceptance of a view. An agreement through pondering views, acceptance. Agreement is not correct there. It should be an acceptance by pondering a view. These five things may turn out in two different ways here and now. So, of course, these five things we've met before in a number of suttas, such as the Chanki Sutta and other places. So this is five ways that we can come to have a view. By faith in it, by ruchi, is approval, preference. By oral tradition, we just accept something because that's what the tradition says. Akara parivitaka is the reasoned cogitation. Okay, so the reasoning, accepting it, and agreement, acceptance of the view after pondering the nijhana kanti. It's a more kind of serious and deep level pondering of the views. Okay, that being the case, what kind of faith do the Venerable Nigantas have in a teacher who speaks about the past? What kind of approval, what kind of oral tradition, what kind of reasoned cogitation, what kind of reflective acceptance of a view? Speaking thus, I do not see any legitimate defence of their position by the Nigantas. Okay, so the Buddha here, the arguments may seem a little bit obscure, but the point is clear enough, is that it's basically what the argument I made before, which is that Nigante himself may be omniscient, but how are we to know whether that he's omniscient or not? So even though we can base a claim, it sounds like we've got a solid claim, we're basing it on this omniscient teacher, but actually the weak point is our own knowledge of that teacher. So I asked him further, what do you think, friend Nigantas, when there is intense exertion, intense striving, do you then feel painful, racking and piercing feelings due to intense exertion? But when there's no intense exertion, no intense striving, do you then not feel any painful, racking, piercing feelings due to intense exertion? The Nigantas responded, basically, yes. So then the Buddha responds, then it's not proper for you to assert that whatever we experience is caused by what is done in the past. And then he recapitulates that argument. So here is another very important point, which is that they say that these painful feelings that we experience is caused by what's happened in the past, and yet actually it only happens when you're doing those practices. So when you do the ascetic practices, you feel pain. When you don't do the ascetic practices, you don't feel pain. In other words, the pain is a result of the ascetic practices. It's not a result of what was done in the past. It's a result of what you're doing right here and now. Okay? So, again, very pertinent argument, you know, and if people often believe this when they're doing Buddhist meditation as well. You know, you're sitting and people experience pain and then they're told that you're burning off your past karma, yeah? No, you're not burning off your past karma, it just hurts to sit still for long periods of time. It's got nothing to do with past karma. Alright? Okay. Then Buddha goes on to. Okay, we'll come back to Analio's essay here. Actually, I'll just finish this bit before going to Analio's essay. So then another series of questions. What do you think? Can an action whose result is to be experienced here and now, is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced here and now can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced in the next life? No, friend. But is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced in the next life can, through exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced in the here and now? No, friend. Can action to be experienced as pleasure be turned through striving and exertion into an action to be experienced as pain? Can an action to be experienced as pain be turned into one to be experienced as pleasure, and so on? No, friend. What do you think? Can an action ripe to be experienced become one whose result, this is Tanisaro's translation, can an action ripe to be experienced be turned through striving and exertion into an action not ripe to be experienced? The Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation here, is it possible that an action whose result is to be experienced in a matured personality can, by exertion and striving, become one whose result is to be experienced in an unmatured personality? A slightly cryptic phrasing here. Bhikkhu Bodhi gives the an action whose result is to be experienced in a matured personality is a synonym for an action whose result is to be experienced here and now. An action whose result is to be experienced in an unmatured personality is a synonym for an action whose result is to be experienced in the next life. But a specification is made as follows. Any action that yields its result in the same life is one to be experienced here and now, but only an action that produces its result within 7 days is called one to be experienced in a matured personality. Is anyone persuaded?
No.
So anyway, the general tenor of the argument here is straightforward, is that the causes remain the same. It's just, you know, if you have a mango seed, can you then, you know, change the mango seed to give rise to a banana fruit?
Well, these days, of course, you can. You know, genetic engineering and stuff, you tweak it a bit, but you get the point.
What does it mean in this context, this personality?
I don't know, yeah, I'm just having a look at the Pali. I really don't know, and I don't know why Bhikkhu Bodhi has translated it as personality in that case. The Pali here is paripaka vedaniyam, who's to be experienced ripely, or to be ripely experienced, or and not to be ripely experienced. Paripaka vedaniyam. Perhaps it means a feeling whose time has come. Perhaps that's what it sort of means. Yeah, that it's ready to ripen. Can you then make it not ready to ripen if it's already ready to ripen? I think that's probably what it means. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
But if it was that was the case, then you better go in one way, but not the other.
You can't make it either way.
You can.
How do you make it other way?
You can't make it unripe, but you can ripen it. I mean, natural forces for it to ripen, and you can accelerate its ripening.
You can influence it, but the point here is that you can't sort of wield control over it.
It's not the same. It's not like a flip-flop situation. It's not.
Right.
It's not.
You need a little bit of wiggle room as well, of course.
Well, I think if you, yeah, well, I think that it's not. You know, like the plant physiology type terms, it's unripened with an impossibility.
Ripening is
ripening is a natural thing.
It's dependent on the nutrients, on the amount of light and warmth, you know, all these things. So depending on that, the ripening process at a certain rate,
Yeah.
At the time, it's just going to an action, isn't it?
Yeah, we come on, yeah. Okay. Can Sorry?
I don't understand.
Okay, so the basic principle behind all of these things is that can you change something which has a certain nature, can you just change that the nature of that thing? Can you turn a mango into a breadfruit or a breadfruit into a mango? This is basically the idea. Yeah? So that these kamas have been formed in a certain way in the past and you can't just do something to completely change that. Okay. So it's not denying that you can influence it. So of course these things can be influenced in the manner that they reappear, but you can't just completely change something like that. Okay. Sorry, Blake, you're going to say? You're going to say? Right. Yeah. So can action who's to be greatly experienced be one who's to be little experienced, or one who's little experienced be one who's great to be experienced? Okay. Actually, elsewhere the Buddha says that you can do that, doesn't he? That's what the simile of the salt, the spoonful of salt is all about, that you can make something which is even has a great experience, you can make it to be small. I guess the difference here is that here it's saying that it can be changed through striving and exertion. Yeah. Whereas in the simile of the salt, it's not through, because striving and exertion here means doing the ascetic practices.
Yeah.
That's right. The simile of the salt is that it's through performance of actual good karma. And similarly, you can't change one that is to be experienced into one that is not to be experienced. So you can't make it go away. And so, and in each case, they agree with the Buddha. And so, and the Buddha then says that this being so, the Venerable Nigantha's exertion is fruitless. Okay, their practice is fruitless. Sorry, I'm not asking. I'm not understanding.
Right now,
question.
He's asking both things.
Yeah.
Then they just say no friend, but no friend doesn't mean that they actually agree with Buddha or whatever, isn't it? I mean, you can ask me a question and just say no, but then later on say, okay, well, say no. Then later on, you can just tell me when you say no, it is wrong because it can be done.
Right. Yeah.
So I have to see. I mean, we have to see what is
Okay, so the idea is that he's asking them. This is another example of what we call the Socratic method. Okay, so the Socratic method is that you ask questions to lead a person on from where they're already at. So he's asking the questions which he would presume are probably common sense and which he thinks most likely they will see things in the same way. So he gets them to agree with this sort of series of statements, and then at the end of it says, well, the fact that you agree with those statements is inconsistent with the practices that you're doing. Yeah. Does that make sense? I'm not quite sure what the problem is there.
It's okay, let me just continue. Because I was thinking that one of the things that I said before this passage is like, it's just that the things that especially just talk about an experience that can be turned through striving and exertion into an action barely to be experienced.
Mm-hmm.
Because we know that we can actually change our future by doing practices, purification.
Uh-huh.
But they say no threat.
Uh-huh.
So it doesn't mean that, for me, my understanding is that the Buddha was just asking whether can this be done, but the Nigantas and Sutta say no threat. Okay? For me, I just take it to be the Buddha was just asking a question and then they answer. But maybe later on the Buddha probably would have disputed the answers about why he said no, it cannot be done.
No. He's giving these examples of questions which he thinks are more or less self-evident.
Mm.
He thinks that this is more or less self-evident. Yeah. That you can't change the nature of a karma that's been done in the past. This is the point here. You've done that action has already been done in the past, and you can't change the essential nature of that. Sorry, are we still on Aya's question? Is this relevant? Sorry, I just wanted to depart from Aya's question for a moment. Sorry, go on.
There's one which she does ask, which is possible to experience another result in place of one which you would have otherwise experienced. Duration.
Uh-huh.
It's like, say, you need more Brahma realms, you need more experience than ill comes.
Well, not necessarily. It just means you don't experience them at that time. Yeah. But that would be like an experience, an action which was ripe to be experienced. So if the idea between of that is that there are certain kinds of karmas which will reap their will have their result in the next life. Yeah. So some kinds of karmas are like that, yeah? That you'll do a karma that will have its result in the next life, and those kinds of ones you can't make them.
Yeah.
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 Could be, or could be in the future. Yeah, could be either. Yeah. So, Dana, just to check, are we still on the same question? Yeah. I'd like to stick with Aya's. No, I'd like to stick with Aya's question here because it's an important question. So I don't want to depart from it. Yeah. Okay.
There is an assumption that like predetermined view of the universe, you know, is coming predetermined that there are actions to be experienced. And once you take that and believe it fully, you can't possibly change it. See what I mean? If you believe this is to be experienced as a statement, absolute statement, well, whatever you do then, it's like predestination kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
Then we can't change the three options. And it seems to me that in India they did have some of the predetermined.
Well, that's what's brought up in the next section, yeah? Yeah?
But for me, if I go to the answering Buddha questions that the first one came, an action wrapped to the experience, the terms of striving and assumption into an action not wrapped to the experience. My understanding is something which I may have to, let's take what is so called retribution, okay?
Okay.
Like, okay, if I murder somebody, I probably will be not bad police if, you know, the conditions for that. But if I know how to do certain things to get away from it, I probably don't have to be arrested at all.
Right.
So I can actually turn that experience if I have
directions. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
And
so
But in that case, that's not an action which would be ripe to be experienced. Okay. So an action which would, an example of this would be, say, murdering your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's an action which is ripe to be experienced. That means that's an action whose result will definitely be experienced in your next life. Mm-hmm. So the question here is, if I've committed the bad karma of murdering my mother, which is an action which will inevitably result in a bad destiny in my next life, can I do anything to stop that from having that result? Okay, and the answer, of course, is no, I can't. Mind boggles.
This section here, does it specifically refer to those very heinous kind of action, or is it just any kind of action?
It refers only to those actions if our interpretation is correct here, it refers only to those actions which will definitely be experienced in the next life, whose nature is to be experienced in the next life. That's why it's called right to be experienced. Yeah? It's a matter of definition. It's defined the karma in that sense. So this particular kind of karma, it's not talking about any kind of karma, it's saying, is this particular kind of karma which has this specific nature, can it be made to not have this nature?
By striving and exertion,
yeah.
As opposed to other things that you might do.
Exactly, yeah. Yep.
Like meditating and purifying your mind and thinking.
And things we're probably thinking of. Is that
clear? I'm just thinking of like the Malaka.
Yeah, uh-huh.
This is talking about ascetic practices in specifically talking about using aesthetic practices to get these results. Not other practices that you might practice.
Yeah.
About the analogy of mother giving birth to a child. You know, the child is about to be born, so it's action and exertion can't stop it. This is the Anguilla Malachi, many people say he's supposed to be born as a hierarchy, but because he actually strives and attains Arahanta, so he doesn't have to be born again.
That's right, but he didn't do that by doing Jaina ascetic practices.
So this, when the Buddha asked this question, he was just, the action that he made was specifically to the Nigantasa on
That's right, yeah. Because the Buddhist idea is that these things are let go of because of understanding, yeah, and letting go, yeah, disidentifying from it. So, whereas their idea is more of a mechanical thing, that there's this stuff and it's actually burnt off. Yeah, it's almost like a physical sense that this stuff is actually burnt away. There's a different, and that's specifically what it's referring to. The whole thing is about the Jains and their practice of exertion. Mm. Yeah?
And the critical distinction is that this is talking about changing the existing results, the existing actions. It's not going to be just form a new action, new disruption, not by the right.
So let's continue on to the next. Let's continue on to the next section, and let's see if these things become more clear as we go on. But first of all, we'll have a bit of a look at the corresponding with the Majjhima Agama parallel. According to the Pali Canon, the Nigantas explained that their practice was based on the teacher's instruction, who was omniscient. The Majjhima Agama discourse reports the same at a later point after the Buddha had further examined the premises of the asceticism of the Nigantas. So the Majjhima Agama version does not record that Nigantas claimed their teacher to be omniscient. In reply to the Nigantas' reliance on their teacher, according to both versions, the Buddha pointed out that faith, liking, oral tradition, reasoning, and acceptance of a view should not be taken as sufficient basis for knowledge. So here's the Chinese versions of those Pali terms. Both versions disclose the conditional relationship between the intensity of the pain experienced by the Nigantas and the intensity of their striving, concluding that the Nigantas were themselves responsible for the pain they experienced. In both versions, the Nigantas had to admit that it was not possible to change the time when the fruit of one's former deeds ripen, or to turn karmic retribution to be experienced as unpleasant into pleasant retribution and vice versa, or else to convert a deed about to ripen into a deed not yet ripening and vice versa. The Pali version also examines the possibility of changing the intensity with which a deed will be experienced and the possibility that the fruition of a deed can be completely avoided. Okay, so the Devadaha Sutta, so that's as far as we've got up to so far. And we go on to the next point, and I'll just summarize that from continuing in Analio's essay. The Devadaha Sutta and its Majjhima Agama parallel present five grounds for criticizing the Nigantas, explaining that whether the experience of pleasure and pain were to be attributed to one's former deeds, to a creator god, to destiny, or the type of rebirth, or one's present practice, in all cases the Nigantas are to be blamed, as their present painful experiences will then have to be attributed to their former evil deeds, an evil creator god, and so on. While the Majjhima Agama version announces this treatment as a criticism of 5 points, then the Pali version presents the same as counting up to 10 points. Yet the actual criticism mentioned in both versions are only 5 points. Actually explaining them, the Pali recapitulates them and indicates that in their absence the Nigantas is to be censured. This additional presentation is not really 5 additional reasons for criticism, but only a 6th. Thus in this respect the Chinese version seems to be more coherent. So back to the actual text here. Such the teaching of the Nigantas, such being their teaching, 10 legitimate deductions can be drawn that give grounds for censuring them. And the word for a legitimate deduction is sahadhammika vadanuvada. Sahadhammika vadanuvada. Sahadhammika saha means together. Dhammika means in accordance with the Dhamma, sahadhammika, so legitimate. Deduction, vad anu vada. So vada meaning a doctrine, as we found before, and anu meaning following along. So it's quite a nice, a doctrine following a doctrine. Quite a nice way of putting deduction or inference.
Is that a general term for legitimate? Or is it just pertaining to...
Sahadhammika. Not 100% sure. It's probably used quite generally, I would imagine. Yeah.
Legitimate deductions is very
common. Yeah. Look, and quite probably would be used in ordinary language in very similar kinds of senses, yeah. Like the word for what we usually translate as a righteous king is a Dhammika Raja, but actually you could translate it as legitimate king in the same kind of sense, yeah? A legitimate ruler. So if the beings experience pleasure and pain based on what was done in the past, then obviously the Nigantas have done bad things in the past, since they now felt such painful, racking, piercing feelings. Yeah? If pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme god, then the Nigantas surely must have been created by an evil supreme god. It's a somewhat frightening possibility. Here's the Isara Nimana Hetu. Okay, so the creative act is the Nimana. Isara is the supreme god. Isara, usually a word for a creator god in the Indic languages, and similar to the Judeo-Christian god. If beings experience pleasure and pain based on circumstance and nature, the speaker Bodhi has, or Taisara has sheer luck, and the Nigantas must have bad luck, since they now experience such painful, racking, piercing feelings. So the word here is Satta Sangati Bhava. Okay, so Sangati, destiny, and Bhava, and nature. These are some of the terms which were found in some of the five doctrines of the five teachers. Sorry, six teachers. These six radical teachers, some of them have this kind of notion of Sangati Bhava, which we read about in the Samanyapala Sutta. Destiny and nature. If beings experience pleasure and pain based on birth, then obviously the Nigantas have had an evil birth, which is why they feel such painful feelings. And the evil birth here is Abhijata. Abhijati. Okay, so the kind of birth here it means the birth into a particular caste or clan or something like that, birth into a particular station in life. If beings experience pleasure and pain based on efforts in the here and now, then obviously the Nigantas have evil efforts in the here and now, which is why they feel such painful, sharp, racking, piercing feelings. And the words in the here and now is Dhyata Dhamma. It's literally the visible Dhamma, and it always means in this very life. If beings experience painful, and then it continues on with the remaining six, sorry, the remaining five from 6 to 10 is, as Analia pointed out earlier, is that these are simply repeating the earlier five, more or less. If it's based on what they've done in the past, they deserve censure. Even if not, they still deserve censure. If it's based on the creator god, then they deserve censure. If not, they still deserve censure. If it's based on destiny, they deserve censure. If not, they still deserve censure. If it's based on birth, then they deserve censure. If not, they still deserve censure. And if they are based on their efforts here and now, they deserve censure. Even not, they still deserve censure. Such is the teaching of the Nigantas, marks, and such being the teaching of the Nigantas, these 10 legitimate deductions can be drawn that give grounds for censuring them. This is how striving is fruitless, how exertion is fruitless. And how is striving and exertion fruitful? Okay, so coming back after criticizing the Jaina approach, coming back to looking at how the one should practice. Here, Bhikkhu is not overwhelmed with suffering, does not overwhelm himself with suffering, and he does not give up the pleasure that accords with Dhamma, yet he is not infatuated with that pleasure. He knows thus, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades in me because of that striving, and when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me while I develop equanimity. Okay, so you can see how this empirical approach I was emphasizing before, it's not based on just faith in these things, but it's based on actually observing them. These kind of striving leads to these kind of results, and you watch that, you understand it. He strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering which fades away in him because of that determined striving, and he develops equanimity in regard to that particular source of suffering which fades away in him while he's developing equanimity. When he strives for determination, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him because of that determined striving, thus that suffering is ended in him. When he looks on with equanimity, such and such a source of suffering fades away in him while he develops equanimity, thus that suffering is ended. So here, so someone who doesn't weigh themselves down with dukkha and doesn't reject the righteous pleasure. So the righteous pleasure, of course, is any pleasure which is associated with wholesome deeds, especially the pleasure of samadhi, but doesn't become anadhimuchito, mucha, not infatuated, not entangled with that pleasure. Suppose that a man is in love to a woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. He might see that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would not sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking and laughing? Yes, Honourable Sir. Why is that? Because that man loves that woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. Then because that man might think, I love this woman with my mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. Thus sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief and despair arise in me when I see her standing with another man, chatting, joking and laughing. What if I were to abandon my desire and lust for that woman? And then he does so. On a later occasion, he sees that woman chatting and joking with another man. What do you think, Bhikkhus? Would sorrow and lamentation arise in him because of that? No, Bhante, because he no longer loves that woman. So to bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is not overwhelmed with suffering and does not overwhelm himself with suffering, and he does not give up the pleasure that accords with Dhamma, yet he is not infatuated with that Dhamma, and then he practices in that way, thus the exertion is striving and fruitful. So here we can actually have Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation. Oh, we only get one page, and then we don't have the next one. Alright, so 8:38. No. I didn't get a couple of lines of it in this one, unfortunately. So, yeah, please don't blame the sutta for Venerable Tanisaro's translation here. He discerns that when I exert a physical, verbal, or mental fabrication, how do you exert a fabrication against this cause of stress? From the fabrication of exertion, there is dispassion. Buddhist hybrid English here. It strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering. It's much better. Anyway. Okay. Moving on. Okay. The bhikkhu considers thus. While I live according with my pleasure, unskillful mental qualities increase and wholesome states decrease. But when I exert myself in what is painful, unwholesome states diminish and wholesome states increase. What if I exert myself in what is painful? He does so. When he does so, unwholesome dhammas diminish and wholesome ones increase. At a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Why is that? The purpose for which that bhikkhu exerted himself in what is painful has been achieved. That is why at a later time, he did not exert himself in what is painful. Suppose because an arrowsmith were warming and heating an arrow shaft between two flames, making it straight and workable. When the arrow shaft had been warmed and heated between the two flames and had been made straight and workable, then at a later time he would not again warm and heat the arrow shaft and make it straight and workable. Of course, the warmth being the tapas, the inner fire of austerity. Why is that? The purpose which the arrowsmith had warmed and heated the arrow and made it straight and workable has been achieved, and so at a later time he wouldn't need to do so. So in this case, the yamnunaham dukkhaya atanam padaheyanti. So what if I was to exert myself in through dukkha, and through what is suffering. It's one thing to notice here: dukkha translated as painful in both of those things, but it doesn't necessarily mean painful in the sense of the kind of physical self-torture that the Jains are talking about. This relates to what elsewhere is called the dukkha patipada and the sukha patipada. And the dukkha patipada, the painful way of practice, is anything which is, you know, on that kind of the using austerities or making yourself stay up late but specifically in terms of meditation, it's the kind of those meditation objects which tend to be a bit unpleasant, like the contemplation of the parts of the body and these kinds of things. That's what's meant here. It doesn't mean sort of self torment. Dutangas and those kinds of things. Yeah, so you're kind of pushing yourself to overcome specific things. And you do that, again, because of an observable reason, not just because you want to push or because you think that you can burn off your past karma, but because you see these actual tendencies to the unwholesome arising and you notice that it'll help to overcome them. So this is why it's always good to try some of these things out, you know, like, say, eating one meal a day, or staying up all night to meditate, or taking up meditation practices, like corpse contemplations or death contemplations and these kinds of things, which are more challenging. And you can just try these things out, experiment with them and see how they work. Or fasting is another one. Yeah? Some meditators, it works really well, and they fast and then they meditate much better. Others, it doesn't work, makes it worse. So you try these things out and can experiment, and then over time, you get that experience, and so you know what works. So that's how striving is fruitful. Okay, so furthermore, because then a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished and fully awakened, and it then goes on to teach the whole of the gradual training, which Tani Sro has translated in some detail here. Bhikkhu Bodhi's abbreviated most of it. It goes up to the four jhanas and the various kinds of higher knowledge, and thus to the this is how striving is fruitful and exertion is fruitful. So I'll just come back here to the comments about this section. Okay, so where the Pali has that section on how striving can be undertaken so as to be fruitful, that we just read in the Madhyama Agama discourse, it instead highlights that the Buddha's personal knowledge cannot be shaken by anyone in the world. It then indicates that the way to avoid future dukkha is to give up unwholesome bodily, verbal and mental karma and to undertake their wholesome counterparts. Similar to the Pali version, the Madhyama Agama discourse enjoins to not give up the pleasure that accords with the Dhamma. While the Pali version recommended to exertion or equanimity according to what is required by the situation, the Madhyama Agama version instead enjoins to practice without an aspiration or with an aspiration or without such an aspiration, a choice that similarly depends on whether these two modes of practice will lead to the eradication of dukkha. With an aspiration or with a desire, yeah. I wonder whether there's been a slight translation mistake in the Chinese there, where that idea, that character for desire, aspiration, originally meant striving. Anyway, so slightly different but similar idea. So the simile of the man who loves the woman is developed further in the Chinese imagery by suggesting that the woman, they also mentioned that the woman even spent the night with the other man, which would increase his suffering even further. The Madhyama Agama version agrees with the Pali in describing how a monk strives to overcome what leads to an increase of unwholesomeness and to a decrease of wholesomeness. Once this is achieved, he will no longer strive as his goal has been achieved. And they both have the simile of the Fletcher, the arrowsmith. Okay, so then we come to the gradual training. The Pali has a full account of the gradual training. Madhyama Agama version does not have such a full account. Instead, it only depicts how a monk approaches a secluded place, overcomes the five hindrances, develops the four jhanas, and reaches the distraction of the influxes, the asavas, through knowledge of the four noble truths. So it's a similar presentation, but much more brief in the Madhyama Agama version. And interestingly enough, that description in the Madhyama Agama version is actually pretty much similar to the condensed version, the abbreviated version in Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, who actually leads most of that text, which Tanisaro has translated in full. So whether the full account of the gradual training, Venerable Analio suggested that the Chinese is perhaps more plausible in not giving the full account of the gradual training. But it seems to me that it's one of those stock passages which either could be or could not be included at any point in the text. Hard to say which is more plausible. Okay, so then at the end of that teaching, then the Buddha says, such being the teaching of the Tathagata, there can be 10 legitimate deductions that give grounds for praising the Tathagata. Number one, if beings experience pleasure and pain based on what was karma from the past, then obviously the Tathagata has done good karma in the past. Why he feels now such pleasure free from fermentation. This is Tanisaro's translation of Asava, free from defilements, undefiled. Yeah, okay. If beings experience pleasure and pain based on the creative act of a supreme god, then obviously the Tathagata has been created by an excellent supreme god. If pleasure and pain is based on destiny and nature, then the Tathagata must have a good destiny. Then if it's based on a good class, good birth, then he must have been born in a good class. If it was, it depends on you whether you were born exertion in the here and now, then obviously the Tathagata has good exertion in the here and now. And if it's based on... that's it, that's the five. Okay, and then as in both cases, the Pali gives the... inverse, so gives the 10 in total, whereas the Chinese only has 5. Such is the teaching of the Tathagata, and such being the teaching of the Tathagata, these 10 legitimate deductions can be drawn that give grounds for praising him. So that's what the Buddha said. And the Pali discourse concludes at this point, but according to the Madhyama Agama account, the Buddha continues by taking up the 5 hindrances as the 5 conditions for dukkha and their eradication as a condition for freedom from dukkha, a freedom to be reached through practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Thus, while the Pali version ends with the grounds for praising the Tathagata, the Madhyama Agama version has the Noble Eightfold Path as its finale. And notice how these differences between the two, they have their own kind of rebalancing effect. Earlier, the Pali has given the account of the path in much more detail than the Chinese. The Chinese only given a short account of the path, but now at the end, as if to balance that out, the Chinese gives extra teachings on the path. So one bit is kind of different than the other, but the overall effect is much the same. Okay. So this is the Devadaha Sutta, and important points here is of course the first point being that the karma is not, or that our experience of pleasure and pain is not fully determined by past karma, and also a very important point that in terms of our practice, that the purpose of practice is not to burn off past karma. The purpose of our practice is to understand how our mind works and understand what gives rise to the causes for suffering or the causes for freedom from suffering, as is described here, which may sometimes involve difficult practices, yeah? But it's not just doing the difficult practice for the sake of burning off the past karma, it's doing those difficult practices for the sake of making the mind more wholesome in the present life.
After the Christian, the Nikanta, I cannot really find the part before the 10, before he talks about the 10 points.
The first time the 10 points is mentioned, or the second time?
Before
the first one.
Before. Buddha responds to the answers?
So these 10?
Yeah.
Okay. So then the no friend ones?
Yeah.
The no friends, okay. So friends, it seems that an action to be experienced in the here and now cannot be turned through striving and exertion to an action to be experienced in the future life. An action to be experienced in the future life cannot be turned through striving and exertion to an action to be experienced here and now. And so on for the rest of them. An action to be experienced cannot be turned by through striving and exertion into an action not to be experienced. And an action not to be experienced cannot be turned through striving and exertion into an action to be experienced. That being the case, the striving of the Nikantas is fruitless, their exertion is fruitless.
This is the point that I was trying to relate to the questions about.
Mm-hmm.
The Buddha was actually asking them questions, and then they say no. So now the Buddha is saying that in that case, then what you're doing is fruitless.
Right.
Because those questions that the Buddha asked, I mean, from my understanding, those questions that the Buddha asked actually can be done, but to the Gantas, they say it cannot be done. So that's the reason why, you know, the last part of the Buddha says that there being a case of striving of the Nikantas is fruitless, the exercise, the exertion is fruitless. So I mean, I thought not whether my understanding is correct.
No, I think you're thinking misunderstanding the negative here. They're not saying no in the sense of disagreeing with him, they're saying no in the sense of agreeing with him. He's setting up a negative question and he expects them to say no. Yeah, because he also agrees with that negative answer. Okay? Exactly. Yeah. So they're in agreement. The problem is that once you've accepted these things, then their striving becomes fruitless because they know that they've already agreed that through this striving and exertion, so through these ascetic practices that they're doing, they can't influence the karma in any of these ways, and yet they still keep on doing it.
What I thought is the doctrine actually saying that you can.
Yeah, that's
because
right.
When you practice, then you burn them off.
Yeah.
Why would they agree with this?
That's true. And the probably the purpose of the text. See, what you do when you're using this kind of Socratic method is that it's perhaps not an entirely clear example here, but normally the point of the Socratic method is to draw out underlying contradictions that we have in our own belief systems, but that we're not really fully aware of. Yeah? So you start out with somebody who makes a certain statement, and you then sort of draw a set of inferences from that and then show that it actually contradicts with another belief that person has. Okay, so this is the method that he's doing. He's trying to show that there is this kind of internal contradiction in their own beliefs.
Well, my question is, why would they themselves think of it as a contradiction when they just said that we can burn off our karma with this striving, and then being asked through this striving, can we change this karma? They say no.
They say no, yeah.
But then, you know, they just said yes. So why would they suddenly realize that it's a contradiction?
And why wouldn't they?
Well, they already think that by doing the striving, they can burn off the karma. So, and then they already assert that. And then the Buddha asks, well, can this come up through striving? It's almost as if he's asking the same question that they just asserted.
He is, yeah. In a slightly different form.
What's the difference in form? I didn't see the difference.
Well, it's just a slight difference in looking at it. But the difference is that here he's emphasizing this idea of to be experienced. Yeah? And so the implication is that this karma has a particular nature, a particular quality of it, which it already has. So can you change that nature that thing has? Yeah. And so they're agreeing with that. And so he's like drawing them into a trap. Yeah. So they agree. And so this is another way that the argument can be used. So because he's not directly challenging that viewpoint. So if he directly challenged that viewpoint, they would continue to reassert it. Yeah. So he asks the question in a sort of a roundabout way, a slightly different way, to draw this out, and then shows that actually they're holding these two inconsistent
points of view at the same time. Yeah?
So in a way it's like, if the karma is already a certain way,
right,
then can you through asceticism change it?
Right.
And they suddenly realize that, or maybe if it's already that way, then you can't.
Yeah. Something like that. And remember, that, you know, notice that the Buddha's method here, he does it bit by bit. Again, this is part of the Socratic method, is that you don't try to turn over someone's teaching all over all at once, but just like bit by bit. For example, you think of some of the cases where the Buddha was talking to the Brahmins, and there was one sutra, I can't remember which one it was now, but where they said, you know, these things that it's essential for the Brahmin is learning, birth, I can't remember what they are now, the rituals and so on. And so the Buddha says, well, is it necessary to have good birth?
Mm-hmm.
And he says, oh, well, no, actually, it's not necessary to have the good birth. And so he can sort of take it off one by one. But if you challenge the whole lot, then they continue to assert it. So this is, again, using a similar method by breaking the problem down. Yeah. Well, what if we looked at this bit? Yeah, so you say you can burn off all your past karma, right? But what about this particular kind of karma? If the karma is already of that sort that is going to be experienced in this very lifetime, is there anything that you can do about it? It has that nature to be experienced in this lifetime. Can you change the nature of that karma? Well, no, we can't change the nature of that karma. Okay. Well, what about this other kind of karma, which is one to be experienced in a future life? Can you change that one? Well, no, we can't change that one. And what about this other one? And so you're kind of leading them on, leading them on, leading them on. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yeah? No, but it's good. It's good to ask the questions because this makes it clear. Right.
But it can. Yes, and that's what's important.
No, it wouldn't. And it says in other places it says that. You know, it says that Jane says, "Well, be that as it may, we're happy with what we're doing, and we're going to keep on doing it," which is fair enough. What it does do sometimes is it convinces doubters.
Yes.
So the Buddha was raising this when he's talking to the bhikkhus. So presumably what had happened was that some of the bhikkhus were talking and the Jaina ideas were maybe being discussed in the Sangha, and so the Buddha addressed that because maybe some of the monks didn't understand and were kind of doubting about it. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's more like
the Christian Buddhist. Yeah, yeah. Oh, for sure, yeah.
First thing to acknowledge is the need for you to achieve the Buddhist, get people to see the world on this as well, ask the major questions.
Yeah.
So it could also be used to.
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yes.
It's sort of the points of Christian
faith. Definitely, yeah. Yeah, so he's assuming
a common sort of belief in certain things, like a common understanding of karma.
Very much so, yeah. Yep. So done.
Whatever past actions they done wrong, if everything can be just finished by their ascetic practice, irrespective of what it is.
Right.
And it occurs to me, Majjhimanikaya, is it the fourth or the second one there that says how different actions come to end?
Mm.
You know, some come to end by abandoning, some.
That's right, yeah. The Sabhasava Sutta, yeah. The second Sutta, Majjhima too, yeah. Yep, yeah, very true. So, yeah, in this one it doesn't record the response of the Jains, so assume that they probably weren't converted. Although, you know, again, maybe some of them were. It's an interesting thing because that very intensity of the striving and pain that you experience makes you believe it all the more, because you've got so it's really hard to accept that maybe this was all a waste of time, yeah. But of course it does happen. There was a contemporary case actually with a Jain monk who was quite a talented and intelligent fellow. And as I said, it's quite hard to get people to do it, and he was doing all of the practices and so on. And then he began to have more and more doubts about it. And it became quite a story. And he I can't remember his name, but he's gone on to actually become quite a good sort of religious, spiritual, environmental kind of teacher now in India, in a kind of secular way. But then when he disrobed as a Jaina monk, it was a kind of an unthinkable thing to do. And there's so much pressure on to stay as a monk because these communities are so small and under pressure. So he actually ended up, after 5 years or something of doing all these ascetic practices, he had so many doubts, he ended up crawling out of the window in the night and running away. And they chased him and tracked him down for across several cities in India, and eventually found him at a train station or something. And then came and begged him to come back, but he was too far for him to just run. I can't remember, Sunny Dumbo told me that story. I can't remember what his name was.
So what is the best way to use the notion of... Because when people think of the notion of karma as if it's something so scary and destined, mm-hmm. they become motivated to practice
uh-huh.
and don't do that thing.
Yeah.
But if you don't have that notion, then what is the best way to use the notion of karma to practice?
Well, karma is still pretty scary. Mm-hmm. Who's not saying karma is not scary? Mm. You just have to think about it. You think what you've done in this life and all of the times you've broken precepts and think, where's that going to lead me? And around in past lives, how many times have you done all of these things? Yeah. I'm scared. Yeah. Yeah, it's the old carrot and stick.
I think it makes a lot of sense. Good people just thinking, you know, I've done something that I deserve to be punished, but after I got punished, you know, I'm free.
Absolutely, and it's quite a widespread belief, isn't it?
Even Christianity,
If you not realize that there's like eons of lifetimes, so then like otherwise, like,
yeah, that's right.
Which person to buy you?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, if you don't know what they are, yeah, it's hard to put a price on them.
Yeah, it wasn't
Dhammika. Okay, so maybe we could finish up there. So that's the Devadaha Sutta, and a very important, very interesting one from a number of doctrinal perspectives, and one which certainly repays some detailed reflection and contemplation. So next week we will be doing the Panchatthaya Sutta, the 5 and 3, which is another very interesting sutta. A kind of a mini version of the Brahmajala Sutta, which is in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so that'll be Majjhima 102 for next week.